A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Today, we're storming the barricades of a question that's been rattling around your head and ours. Here's what Daniel wrote. He says, SWAT units are good fodder for TV drama and movies, but they also feel like a very American or Americanized phenomenon, both within and beyond the US. How commonplace is it for police forces to have some kind of SWAT or SWAT-like capability? Do these units exist under different names in different localities? And within the US, in places where having a dedicated special forces function might not be sensible or viable, is there still a regional or national backup function in place that can dispatch when required? Okay, there's a lot in there. The core question, I think, is whether this thing we associate with American cop shows is actually an American thing at all, and if not, what does the rest of the world call it? And then the practical question that anyone living in a small town should care about. If something goes very wrong, who shows up?
And the short answer to the first part is, no, it's not uniquely American. Nearly every country with a professional police force has some kind of tactical unit. But the shape of it, the scale, the name, how it's organized, that varies so much that the American model ends up being the weird one, not the default.
The weird one how?
In most countries, tactical capability is centralized. You have one national unit, maybe a few regional ones. France has GIGN, the National Gendarmerie Intervention Group. Germany has GSG9 at the federal level, plus each state has its own SEK, Spezialeinsatzkommando. Australia calls them Special Operations Groups. Canada has Emergency Response Teams. The names are all over the place, but the pattern is the same. A handful of units tightly controlled with standardized training.
And the U.S. has, not that.
The U.S. has roughly 40,000 police departments, nobody knows the exact number, and a significant chunk of them, we're talking thousands, have some form of SWAT team. Not just big cities. Suburbs, small towns, county sheriffs, even some university police departments.
So, the question isn't whether tactical units exist outside the U.S., it's why the U.S. decided to replicate them thousands of times, instead of running a few elite national teams.
That's exactly the right question. And the answer is mostly money and structure. The U.S. doesn't have a national police force. Policing is hyperlocal. Each jurisdiction is its own little sovereignty. So when the federal government started pumping out Homeland Security grants after 9/11, and when the 1033 program started handing out surplus military equipment, the incentive structure said, stand up your own team.
The 133 program being the one that transfers things like armored vehicles and rifles from the Defense Department to local police.
Right. And if you're a police chief in a town of 15,000, and the feds are offering you an MRAP and funding for tactical training, the political pressure to say yes is enormous. Nobody wants to be the chief who turned down free equipment and then had a school shooting.
But that gets to the tension Daniel's really asking about. Is this sensible? If you're a town of 500, should you have a SWAT team?
In most cases, no. And they don't. What they have is a part-time team. Officers who do regular patrol work but train together once or twice a month and get called up when something happens. In a lot of small departments, the SWAT team is basically a few guys with heavier gear and extra training who are still writing traffic tickets the rest of the month.
Which sounds like the worst of both worlds. They're not training enough to be truly proficient, but they're carrying capabilities that escalate situations.
That's the critique. And it's not wrong. The alternative is what Daniel asked about in the third part of his question, regional or national backup.
Let's start with the global picture before we get to the U.S. backup question. You mentioned the names are all over the place. What's the actual taxonomy here?
The Wikipedia list of police tactical units is a goldmine for this. You see names like Rapid Deployment Unit, Intervention Group, Special Operations Group, Police Tactical Unit, Emergency Response Team. Each name tells you something about how that country thinks about the unit's role.
Give me an example.
Take Hong Kong's Police Tactical Unit. The name emphasizes that it's police, that it's tactical, and that it's a stand-in unit. Very bureaucratic, very British colonial legacy. Then you look at France's GIGN, Intervention Group of the National Gendarmerie. It's not defense, it's not response, it's intervention. They go in.
And SWAT itself? Special Weapons and Tactics?
That name emerged from Los Angeles in the late 60s. It was deliberately chosen to sound distinct from military special forces. The LAPD wanted a unit that could handle sniper situations and hostage crises without calling in the National Guard, which had a terrible track record in civil disturbances. The name was meant to signal, we're still police, we just have specialized equipment and training.
But the name became the genre. It's the Kleenex of tactical policing.
In the US, SWAT is the generic term, even though plenty of departments call their teams something else. You'll see SRT, Special Response Team, ERT, Emergency Response Team, TRT, Tactical Response Team, but everyone just says SWAT.
So the US has this proliferation of local teams with inconsistent naming, inconsistent training, inconsistent oversight. How does the rest of the world avoid that?
By making it a national asset. GIGN in France can deploy anywhere in the country within hours. They handle everything from hostage rescue to counterterrorism to organized crime takedowns. The unit is small, around 400 operators, but they're full-time. They train constantly, and they have a centralized command structure.
And Germany?
GSG-9 is the federal unit, created after the Munich Olympics massacre in 1972. That was the moment when West Germany realized its regular police had no capacity to handle a terrorist hostage situation. The unit is part of the federal police and can deploy nationwide. But Germany also has the SEK units at the state level, so there's a middle tier.
So even in a federal system like Germany's, they still only ended up with 16 state units plus one federal unit, not thousands.
Right. Because the German states are the size of small countries. A single German state has more people than most US states. The scale is completely different.
Let's talk about the US backup question then. Daniel asked, if you're a small department that can't sustain a team, who do you call?
This is where it gets messy. There's no single number to call. No 911 for tactical teams.
Walk me through a hypothetical. I'm the police chief of a town of 2,000 people. We have maybe 6 officers total. Someone barricades themselves in a house with a hostage. What happens?
You call the county sheriff. That's step one. Most county sheriffs in the U.S. either have their own SWAT team or participate in a regional task force. If the county can handle it, they roll in and take over the scene.
And if the county can't?
Then the sheriff calls the state police or highway patrol. Most states have a tactical team at that level. Texas DPS has a SWAT team. California Highway Patrol has a special response team. These are full-time or near full-time units with better training and equipment than a county team.
And if that's not enough?
Then you're looking at the FBI's hostage rescue team, HRT, created in 1982 based at Quantico, Virginia. It's the national level asset. Full-time operators, extremely high training standards, can deploy anywhere in the U.S. or internationally.
But they're not the default. They're the last resort.
They're absolutely the last resort. HRT deploys for the most serious incidents, terrorism, major hostage situations, things with a federal nexus. A barricaded suspect in a small town is probably not getting HRT unless it escalates dramatically or involves a federal crime.
So the chain is local part-time team, if you have one, then county, then state, then FBI. And each jump adds time.
And that time can be hours. If you're in a rural county in Montana, the nearest state police tactical team might be 4 or 5 hours away. HRT is in Virginia. In a crisis, that delay is everything.
Which is exactly why small departments feel pressured to have their own capability. The backup isn't fast enough.
That's the fundamental tension. Centralization gives you quality and accountability. Decentralization gives you speed. The U.S. chose speed, and the cost is what you'd expect.
What does that cost look like in practice?
A few things. Training inconsistency is the big one. A full-time HRT operator trains constantly. A part-time SWAT officer in a small department might train 8 hours a month. The gap in proficiency is enormous.
And when things go wrong, they go very wrong.
The Waco siege in 1993 is the canonical example. It started as a local ATF operation, escalated beyond their capability, and eventually the FBI HRT was brought in. By that point, the situation had been mismanaged for weeks. 51 days. The final assault resulted in the deaths of 76 people.
That's not just a failure of tactics. That's a failure of the escalation chain.
And it's a failure that's baked into the system. When you have multiple agencies with overlapping jurisdiction and no clear command structure, you get chaos. HRT is an excellent unit, but by the time they're called, the situation is often already a disaster.
So the patchwork creates two problems. One, local teams might be under-trained and over-deployed. Two, the backup takes too long. Is there any movement toward fixing this?
There's a trend toward regionalization. Instead of every town having its own team, multiple jurisdictions pool resources into a single regional SWAT team. The officers come from different departments but train and deploy together. It's a middle ground between full decentralization and a national unit.
Does that work?
It works better than the every town for itself model. The team trains more, deploys more, builds real proficiency, but it still has the command problems. When the team deploys, who's in charge? The sheriff? The police chief of the town where the incident is happening? The team leader?
The answer being, it depends.
It always depends. That's the through line of American policing. Everything is negotiated, everything is jurisdictional, nothing is standardized.
Let's go back to the global comparison for a minute. You said the US is the weird one, but is there any other country that does it the American way?
Not really. Canada comes closest because it's also federal and geographically enormous, but even Canada's model is more centralized. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police has its own tactical teams, and major cities have their own, but you don't see the kind of hyperlocal proliferation you see in the US.
What about somewhere like Brazil?
Brazil's interesting. They have BOP, the Special Police Operations Battalion, which is a state-level unit in Rio de Janeiro. It's famous for operating in the favelas. But BOP is a single, highly trained unit for a massive city. It's not replicated in every neighborhood.
So the US really is an outlier in terms of quantity and decentralization.
It's an outlier in quantity, decentralization, and also in the blurring of the line between police and military. That's the thing Daniel's prompt hints at with the word Americanized. SWAT looks military. The gear, the tactics, the language. In other countries, there's often a brighter line.
Though GIGN and GSG9 are also paramilitary.
They are, but they're explicitly structured as elite national units with clear legal frameworks. GIGN is part of the Gendarmerie, which is a military force with police duties. The legal distinction is baked in. In the US, a local SWAT team is just regular police officers with military equipment, and the legal framework is thinner.
Thinner meaning what?
Meaning less clarity about when they can be used, how they report, what the rules of engagement are. A lot of it's department policy, not law.
So we've got a system where thousands of local teams exist with varying standards, a backup chain that can take hours, and a legal framework that's more policy than statute. What does the data say about how often these teams are actually used?
That's part of the problem. We don't really know. There's no national database of SWAT deployments. The FBI collects some data through the Uniform Crime Reporting Program, but it's voluntary and incomplete. Some researchers have tried to piece it together from media reports and FOIA requests.
And?
The estimates suggest something like 50,000 SWAT deployments per year in the US. But that number is soft. It could be 40,000, it could be 80,000. Nobody knows for sure.
50,000 deployments a year. That's more than 100 a day.
And the vast majority of those are for serving search warrants, not hostage rescue or active shooters. That's the other critique. SWAT teams were created for rare, high-risk situations, but they've become a routine tool for drug raids and warrant service.
Which is a whole other episode.
It is. But it connects to Daniel's question about viability. If you have a SWAT team, you're going to use it. Otherwise, why do you have it? The equipment and training cost money, and you need to justify the expense.
So the small town that stands up a part-time team ends up finding reasons to deploy it.
And that's where the accountability problems compound. More deployments mean more chances for things to go wrong, and with inconsistent training, things do go wrong.
Let's pivot to the practical side. Daniel didn't just ask for an explanation. He's asking, implicitly, what should someone know about their local situation?
The most practical thing is to find out who your first backup is. If you live in a small jurisdiction, ask your local police department or sheriff's office who handles tactical incidents here. Is there a regional team? What's the response time?
And they'll actually tell you that?
In a lot of places, yes. It's not classified information. Many departments have mutual aid agreements that are public record. You can also look at your county's emergency operations plan, which is often available online.
That's surprisingly accessible.
It is. The harder question is what their training standards are and how often they deploy. That information is less likely to be volunteered, but it's still something a citizen can ask. And when citizens ask, departments pay attention.
So there's a transparency angle here. The more people ask, the more pressure there's for departments to be forthcoming.
The more pressure there's to justify the existence of a team. If a department has a SWAT team that deploys twice a year and trains 8 hours a month, a citizen might reasonably ask whether that money would be better spent on something else.
Oh, what?
Like training patrol officers in de-escalation and crisis intervention. There's a growing recognition that the most likely tactical scenario in a small town isn't a hostage siege. It's a mental health crisis involving someone with a weapon. And that's a situation where a SWAT team might be the wrong tool entirely.
Because SWAT is trained to dominate and control, not to de-escalate.
Right. And the trend in policing generally is toward integrating crisis intervention into patrol work rather than calling in the heavy team. Some departments are training all their officers in tactical emergency casualty care and active shooter response, so the first officers on scene can act immediately instead of waiting for SWAT.
Which blurs the line between SWAT and regular policing in the other direction. Instead of SWAT becoming more routine, regular officers are becoming more tactical.
That's the direction things are heading. After high-profile active shooter incidents, the doctrine shifted from contain and wait for SWAT to first officers on scene go in immediately. That's a fundamental change in how patrol officers are trained.
The future might be fewer dedicated SWAT teams, but more tactically capable patrol officers.
Possibly. Or it might be more regionalization. Or it might be both. The one thing that seems unlikely is the status quo persisting unchanged. The pressure on police budgets, the scrutiny of militarization, the legal liability, all of it's pushing toward consolidation and professionalization.
The irony being that the U.S., which looks like it has the most SWAT teams, might actually be moving toward a model that looks more like everyone else's.
Slowly, very slowly, and with a lot of local resistance. Every police chief who has a SWAT team wants to keep it. It's a point of pride, a career achievement, a budget line item that's hard to claw back.
It's also a signal to the community. We can handle anything.
Even if that's not quite true. Even if the team is six guys with surplus gear who train once a month, the signal matters more than the reality, politically.
All right, let's land this. We've covered the global landscape, the naming taxonomy, the U.S. decentralization, the backup chain, the accountability gaps. What's the thing you want listeners to take away?
Two things. First, if you live in a small jurisdiction, know your local escalation path. Who shows up when things go wrong, and how long will it take? That's information that exists and that you can find out.
And second?
Second, the American model is genuinely unusual, and it's worth asking whether the trade-offs are worth it. Speed versus quality, local control versus accountability, proliferation versus standardization. These are real choices, not inevitabilities.
The patchwork has costs. Whether those costs are acceptable is a question every community should be asking, not just accepting.
Asking it before something goes wrong, not after.
On the record, one concrete prediction each. Herman?
Within 3 years, at least one U.S. state will pass legislation requiring all SWAT deployments to be reported to a centralized state database with standardized metrics. The patchwork of voluntary reporting can't hold.
I'll go a different direction. Within 2 years, a major civil rights lawsuit against a small department SWAT team will result in a consent decree that effectively forces regionalization in that jurisdiction. And it'll become a template. That's a wrap on this raid. Next time, we'll breach another weird prompt.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping the comms clear.
This has been My Weird Prompts.
If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps more than you'd think.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
thanks for listening to our show. My weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.